last night. I cleared through the full backlog of The Last Dance. If you're anything like me, you pushed refresh on Netflix until finally the last two episodes ticked over. Boy, they were magnificently told, weren't they? Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, the finale last night.
In 98, Krause already said at the beginning of the season, Phil can go 82-0, and he was never going to be the coach. So when Phil said it was The Last Dance, it was The Last Dance. We knew they weren't going to keep the team. Now, they could have nixed all of it at the beginning of 98. Why say that statement at the beginning of 98? If you ask all the guys who won in 98, Steve Kerr, Jeff Busler, blah, 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 we give you 1 year contract to try for 7. You think they would have signed? Yes, they would have signed. Would I sign for 1 year? Yes, I would have signed for 1 year. I've been signing 1 year contracts up to that. Would Phil done it? Yes.
So is it then satisfying to leave at your peak?
No.
Or is it maddening to leave at your peak?
It's maddening, you know, because I felt like we could have won 7. I really believe that. We may not have, but man, just not to be able to try, that's something that, you know, I just can't accept.
Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, talking about the dismantling of his Chicago Bulls post his 6th title at the end of the 1998 season. Andrew Gaze, I know he sat glued. Of course he did. The voice of basketball. Thanks for joining us, Gazey.
No problems at all. And, it's only been a day, but almost going through withdrawals already, just knowing that we don't have something to look forward to next Monday, because it has been riveting. And I'd say, although it's I'm biased, of course, because of my interest in the sport, but I think you'd struggle to see a better documentary about an extraordinary time in basketball history.
Exactly. I think the sign of a good doco, isn't it, Gaze, is when you know the ending, you know how it ends, but the way it is told still puts the hairs on the back of your neck up, and it still provides those spine-tingling moments. And the way they retold that 6th title was it was amazing.
It was, and it was one, like you say, you knew what the outcome was, but just the story, the magnitude of the story, and, it was a team and an individual that transcended the sport. And let's not forget that it was in an era where not every single highlight, every word, every controversy was being tweeted and shared and spoke about, but yeah. Yet it was such a significant part in sporting history that most of us, certainly those that were around during that generation, remember it. And, of course, Michael Jordan, not only the greatest basketball player in the world, but when you see a documentary like that, you sort of even goes a little further and you start to think, well, he's in the conversation for the greatest athlete that's ever lived.
I think you make a good point, because enough time has gone now, hasn't it, Gazey, whereby younger generations are maybe watching a lot of this stuff for the first time. And a point was made in the documentary last night that imagine brand Jordan with social media and the means of publicity that we have now.
It is. It would be extraordinary. And one of the things that I also admire Michael Jordan about is that even since the introduction of social media, he has not had anything to do with it. None of the social platforms that I'm aware of that he is involved with, and maybe that's just his personality and wanting to be so private. And when you see what he had to go through at the peak of his powers, how there's not a nook and cranny in the world that you could go to that wasn't aware of what he was doing and the impact that he was having on basketball, and you see that the attention that drew on him, you can kind of understand why he might have just said, well, I don't need any of that. But I guess it also does show the power that he had, because I think in one of the comments towards the end, before Michael Jordan came along, the NBA games were shown in, 70 or 80 countries throughout the world. By the time his career had finished, it was in over 200, and maybe not exclusively because of him, but certainly he had a significant influence on taking the game to the people.
Unfortunately, time does dilute the memory, though, doesn't it? I mean, it was just a reminder, and there were probably more in the final two episodes than we'd seen right throughout, that he was a guy, Gaze, he was just the king of clutch. I mean, no one compares. I mean, younger generations have an understanding of it now. I mean, who has delivered in world sport more when the chips are down, when the pressure is at its fiercest and the microscope at its most concentrated? This guy stood up time after time after time and delivered.
He did, and a lot of people have come away from this and has opened up conversations about whether the methods that he used was one that you could hold up in today's society, and two, whether even back then it was appropriate. A lot of comments that I've heard from people having conversations about the documentary have referred to him as being a bit of a bully. Mm. But I think that in the judgment of it all, you say, well, it was his personality type. He got the absolute very best out of himself. And as you say, he was able to step up in big moments. And although he may not be loved by his teammates, I think that there's no doubt that he would be highly respected. And I would suspect that they would look back on it and have a strong sense of gratitude to being involved in and having the opportunity to play with him and involved in those teams because of what he individually brought to the table, as difficult as it may have been.
Well, you shared a locker room with Steve Kerr, obviously, in 99 at the San Antonio Spurs, and Steve Kerr features prominently in the documentary, of course, and he's had, he was one of many to have run-ins with Michael Jordan, and there's a great moment, wasn't there, where the two found a common ground. I mean, did Steve ever speak about Michael Jordan in the times that you were with him?
Yeah, absolutely he did. And it was me just being a fan at the time. And a lot of those things that we've been revealed in the documentary, I was asking questions about it because we heard about it. You know, we'd heard about the time when Scottie Pippen didn't go in the game for the last 1.8 seconds. I'd heard about the tragic circumstance of his dad. And of course, we'd heard about the fight that he'd had with Michael Jordan. And Steve was very candid about it when you talk about it. He didn't hold back, and he didn't sort of make it into a huge issue or paint it, or exaggerate the story, other than to say that it was the scariest thing that he ever did. But in hindsight, he said it was the best thing he possibly could have done, because from that point on, he gained Michael Jordan's respect. And the way he described it was that he never really bothered him from then on out. He tells a story. I remember the time he was actually reading a book, because it was the season after this, and there was some book about the Bulls or Jordan specifically, and we were on a plane, and I was curious to see him reading it and asking him about some of those stories. And it was in that context of him reflecting on other people's interpretation of what went on that he didn't have to put any mayo on any of the stories, because they were just incredible, and stuff that you thought at the time, you'd almost think to yourself, turn up, Steve, you got to be kidding me, don't you? How could Dennis Rodman, in between games of a championship series, go and do a WWE exhibition wrestling match? And you're thinking, surely not. But yeah, that is sort of the things that happened, and it kind of revealed that they were that ridiculous and hard to believe at the time, that now in hindsight you remember and think back to it and you go, well, there's no mayo on it. It's exactly what happened. So it was a great experience for me, and of course it was right on the heels of that, of him, Steve Kerr, being involved in that. And also Will Perdue was on that team that I was in, and he had some great Michael Jordan stories as well.
Oh, geez, I love Dennis. He provided some laugh-out-loud moments right throughout the documentary, including the finale, where it's a bit too profanity-laden to repeat here, but he went into the details of Michael Game 6 in 98. He's going to shoot this, such and such.
Yeah.
But such was the iconic photo of that shot over Brian Russell. You know, I thought how was the stills of the crowd there at the Delta Center? You know, such an iconic photo. The way they retold that was brilliant. And the fatigue as well. I mean, how real is that as a player in the NBA? It's a relentless campaign, isn't it, in a season, night after night. And he did it, Michael, and he did it with everything that was going on in the background and around him. And his trip from the stadium to the hotel wasn't a typical one either.
And that was just the norm for him, even if it wasn't in the final series. That whatever city he'd go to, it'd just be like a rock star. The Beatles were coming to town. And, you know, I was one of those fans. I remember going and spending some time, went and visited Luke, and Shane Heal was in the league at the time. And we went and watched the game when the Bulls played Minnesota in Minnesota. And just the people getting to the game early, wanting to see the shoot around. And then when I was with Luke in Chicago and just seeing the way in which the adulation that was being shared for the team and for Luke Longley for that matter, you know, like he's 7'1" tall. Luke couldn't walk down the middle of the city. He was recognized by every single person in the city of Chicago and throughout most of the United States because he was part of this incredible experience. And the big fella just took it in his stride and it was sort of nothing to him. But for me, to see that and see what they had to deal with on a daily basis and magnified that by about 100 times for what Jordan had to experience, and you could understand why he perhaps needed that spell halfway through his career and wanted to step away from the game, and why even after the end of that season that he took a time off before he came back and with that last stint with the Washington Wizards.
And Gazy, for more than 20 years, it has lived on as the so-called flu game of 1997. I think you probably knew this. The dodgy pizza, it was actually the food poisoning game, as it turned out, just before game 5 of the finals that year.
Yeah, well, we always assumed that it was the flu and it's just a bug that he caught. And there was that. They were sort of alluding to the fact that perhaps there might have been some spiking of the pizza going on. Well, that's the way I interpreted it anyway, yep. That perhaps the locals there...
The five delivery men.
The five delivery men, just to say, here it is. But whatever it is, the first and foremost, I was surprised that it that late in the night, you know, you're hungry, that he would have reached for a pizza, probably chugging on a cigar at the same time, such as the greatness of this man, that his diet and his cigar habit was an extra handicap that he had to deal with. But yeah, it was an illness, the food poisoning that he got, and the way in which he was still able to will himself to play at such a high level when his team needed him the most. And then, of course, in the game 6, where Scottie Pippen just was wrecked through a back injury, so Michael had to carry that extra burden and did it so well. And just to push himself and that competitive drive that he had is the thing that sticks out the most throughout this series.
I reckon the thing that stuck out the most for me just about through the whole series, Gazy, was the cigars. I always knew he was fond of one, but I didn't realise he had one hanging out of his mouth every 5 minutes.
No, exactly. I thought it was something that he spoiled himself at the end of the season. They won a title, he'd break out the big Cuban. But it seemed like that it was an ongoing thing, and he's continued to with that habit. So, you know, for the youngsters out there just listening in, hopefully they don't think that you can just chug on a Cuban and it's not going to have an impact on your game and also your long-term health, because it's not a great thing to be doing. But it certainly... he was able to do it. Maybe it was one of those things, a little vice that he had that helped him along the journey. But for most mere mortals, chugging on a cigarette or a Cuban, you know, a cigar is generally not going to be conducive to good athletic performance.
A lot of reasons I won't show it to the kids, but that one is up there. Hey, Gazy, we'll change tack just quickly before we let you go to the domestic competition. Now, a lot of talk about the Illawarra Hawks and administrators wanting to liquidate the franchise. The NBL are at pains to say that they're progressing towards finding the next owners of the franchise. Do you still think there's a suitable buyer in the works?
We all hope so. And, of course, LaMelo Ball and his team that he's got around him, they're the ones that have put their hand up and said that they'd be interested in buying the team. And I guess in these circumstances where the Australian dollar is makes it real attractive for those that are earning US dollars, and particularly in LaMelo's case, he's going to be earning a lot of US dollars, and the family's involvement, you'd say that they would have the resources to do it. And I think, though, that it's great to have that international ownership and particularly those involved in the sport and the NBA and what they can bring to the NBL, I think has huge potential. But I also think you do need a strong local presence because it's different. You've got to understand the culture, and particularly in a smaller town like Wollongong, in order to engage the fans. Winning does that, but also you really do need to build that local representation. So hopefully Larry and his team can put an ownership group together. But as I understand it, that the NBL and primarily Larry, that they have already declared that if a suitable buyer is not there, then they are prepared to take over the team. And we read this week that they still have some outstanding payments of something in the order of $750,000. So it's not going to be a cheap exercise, but it's got huge potential. It's a beautiful venue and a great place to play a game of basketball. It's a beautiful city that love the game, and they're one of the inaugural clubs. So we're hopeful that that happens, but they've been down this path a number of times, and there are some big challenges facing the team. And on top of that, with the coronavirus situation, it's not an easy assignment, but we're hopeful. And I think most people internally, the rumours suggest that they will survive, and in the short term anyway, and they'll continue on, which is great news.
Gazy, brilliant. Always a pleasure to hear your voice. And yeah, fingers are crossed for the Illawarra Hawks, and we're all shattered that the last dance is over. But I know Dwayne's appreciated it. Thanks for joining us every week to run the rule over the doco.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm going to go back and rewatch the whole thing. I might binge it one, just watch all 10 again and shed a tear and get excited again. But I appreciate it, and hopefully your listeners enjoyed watching the documentary.
Andrew Gaze, basketball icon.